I've been walking around my own life as if I was more than enough. When have I ever been enough? I have to wait another 2 days before I am alone in the house. It's Saturday morning and Lewis has taken the children to the ice rink while I plead a headache. The moment they're gone, I go through his things. It's almost a ritual by now. I go through his pockets, his shoes, his drawers, under his drawers, his emails, cell phone bills, especially cell phone bills. Nothing. I check his toiletries bag for condoms. There are none. And I stand there, knowing that finding nothing doesn't prove he's not still seeing Isabel. It just means I found nothing. I don't even know what I'm looking for, and I really do get a headache. I press my fingers on my temples as I gaze out to the back garden and the shed. I should go to his studio and search there. That's what I should do. If there's anything to find, that's where it will be. Then I focus my eyes. The shed. The shed is completely Lewis's domain. I hardly ever go in there. And why would I? It's where he tinkers with his bikes. There's nothing for me there. Which makes it the perfect hiding place. I unlock the door and catch a whiff of chain oil. His red bicycle is resting upside down in the center, tools carefully laid out on the bench, ready to perform some intricate operation. Sometimes I think there's nothing wrong with his bicycle, but men are like children and they need toys to tinker with. And so Lewis goes to his man shed, takes his bicycle apart, rebuilds it, takes it apart again. It doesn't take long to figure out I'm wasting my time here. I've looked under every tin of paint, shaken out every oily rag, searched drawers forensically. The only remotely incriminating thing I've found is a half-empty packet of Marlboros behind the antique wooden toolbox I gave him years ago. It's only when I'm about to give up that I spot his canvas bag in the corner, the kind that you strap diagonally across your torso, like bicycle couriers use. I open the flap and there's nothing there, except for a packet of Listerine strips, which is certainly interesting in itself, and I wonder what they're for. Kissing, perhaps? There's a pocket at the front with its own flap, and inside, carefully folded in half, is a receipt from Mole Creations. I smile. It's the receipt for the earrings Lewis bought me to celebrate the Penty Stone win. Except it's not. It's the right jewelry store, Mole Creations. But the date is wrong. The receipt is from 3 months ago. Lewis gave me the earrings only 10 days ago. Could he have bought this for me? Something for my birthday, maybe? But that's in another 4 months, and our wedding anniversary is another month after that. It doesn't seem like Lewis to plan a gift so far in advance. I'm biting down on my teeth so hard I'm going to crack them if I don't unlock my jaw soon. I hold the receipt in my fist and crush it slowly, because the worst part is, the receipt is not for the pair of heart-shaped earrings. It's for a necklace. 14-karat gold. And it cost $510, which is 3 times as much as my earrings. Necklace, 14-karat gold, does not tell me much, and I absolutely have to know what it looks like. Is it pretty? Is it sexy? Does it spell her name between 2 interlocking hearts? Lewis has taken the car, so I take an Uber to the jewelry store. In the back seat, I stare out the window, fingernails digging into my palms. The driver is chatting idly about the weather, what else, and checking me out occasionally in the rearview mirror. I ignore him. I don't trust myself to speak without yelling furiously. Yes, it's cold, isn't it? Instead, I close my eyes and make myself breathe through my nose because I can't go in there with this out-of-control anger barreling through me. I'll end up smashing something. Not a good look in a jewelry store, I don't think. By the time I walk in, I've regained some control. I hand my receipt over to a pretty blonde woman with a very elaborate hairdo, lots of makeup and a bright smile that doesn't reach her eyes. If they ever did a remake of Stepford Wives, she'd be perfect. My husband bought this for me, I say.
Lucky you, she replies, and I nod.
Lucky me.
I was wondering if I could have it resized.
Desperate, obviously.
Lame, even.
I don't know what size it is to begin with. What if it's one of those long, loopy necklaces that drops down to the navel?
Oh, well, let's take a look. Did you bring it with you?
No, I just wanted to know if it was possible first. Do you have another one here? I laugh for no reason whatsoever, waving the crumpled receipt in front of her. She raises her eyebrows and looks towards the door, as if to gauge her escape route. This is going completely wrong. She's going to have me arrested if I don't come down soon.
May I?
I nod, and she takes the receipt from me carefully, using the very tip of her fingers, and smooths out the receipt on the glass counter.
I don't need to look it up. The design is listed right here, see?
I squint, then I see it. L-I-L-I-I, it says, right above her long red fingernail.
That's the model of the necklace.
Oh, I thought it was... I don't know what I thought. Some kind of inventory naming convention, I guess.
Unfortunately, I don't have another one here, she says.
I bite a fingernail.
Do you have a picture of it I could look at? I'd really like to discuss with you how resizing it would work.
Certainly. She pulls out a catalog from under the counter, flicks it open, and turns it around so I can see it.
Here we are. It sits above the collarbone. Is that not the case for you?
She tilts her head and looks at my neck, which is of normal size and certainly not so big that this necklace won't wrap around it. But I'm not listening to her anymore. I pull the catalog closer and stare at it. The necklace is shown in a full-page color photograph, and the only word for it is exquisite. Of course, the artist and the curator. What else could it possibly be? It's a fine gold chain, as fine as a gossamer thread, with two narrow baguette diamonds on one side, just above the collarbone. I'm going to be sick. My silver heart-shaped earrings suddenly feel trite, the kind of gift you give your wife to show you appreciate her, but without the investment. A gift for the giver's benefit, just one step up from a KitchenAid. I snatch up the receipt from the glass counter and walk out.
Chapter 19. It's been 2 days, and I've been ruminating incessantly about the necklace. I did another forensic search that afternoon, in case there is a pretty gift box with my name on it hidden somewhere. It goes without saying that I didn't find one. I was almost tempted to confront him about it, but then I thought, the gift isn't recent. What if it was given in the heat of lust? What if it is over between them? Louis has been attentive to me lately. We are happier, aren't we? And what if the gift really is for me? How will it look if I've been snooping around, checking his receipts? You're so jealous sometimes, Anna. Why can't you trust me? No. I made the decision. I absolutely have to pretend everything is fine until I figure out what's really going on here. And now, it's Sunday morning, and Louis and I are strolling around the flea market, holding each other's gloved hand. I have a thing for winter outdoor markets. I love them. I love the icy air on my cheeks, the vendors with their fingerless gloves, the white sky, the promise of snow. I'm warm in my duffel coat, a blue and white woolen scarf that Carla knitted for me a few weeks ago around my neck. It's a new hobby for her, and we're all wearing beanies that are too small and scarves that are strangely misshapen, and I love them all to bits. Louis stops to look at a Bakelite clock, and I turn around, scanning for the source of that roasted chestnut smell. I nudge Louis. Do you want some? He looks up.
Sure.
The vendor is roasting them on a hot plate and selling them in paper cones.
I'm digging up the right change, fingers like blocks of ice, when a voice behind us calls out,
"Louis?"
We both turn around. Isabel.
"Hello," she says, smiling at my husband.
She's stunning with her bright smile and her blonde hair cascading out of an elegant black fur hat. She looks like she's just stepped out of a Disney movie. I am not an angry person. I am a happy person. I am calm and dependable. Everyone says that about me. But right now I am livid as I watch my husband kiss her quickly on the cheek with a fake, desultory, "Hey, how are you?" All very chaste, that goes without saying. I am here, after all. But my lips are trembling as I say hello through gritted teeth, because is this meeting really accidental? They're standing too close to each other, and it's making me boil. I imagine myself pushing her away with both hands, palms slapped hard against her long black leather coat. I picture her stumbling backwards and hitting her pretty head on the asphalt. I imagine her mouth making a perfect O of surprise, and her blue eyes wide in shock, and fear too, until her eyelids close like the eyes of a vintage doll. Then I imagine the blood. A tiny rivulet at first, seeping from the back of her head so slowly we don't notice it until it grows into a pool and we have to step away so as not to get it on our shoes. I imagine everyone agreeing it was an accident. The heels of her tall leather boots were too high, too thin, too unstable. Silly girl, she couldn't keep her balance. I sigh. As tempting as it is, I don't push her. Because I am a happy person. And a rallier, which is why I make myself smile. It takes some effort, but after a few tries, I get there. Then I realize they're waiting for me to say something. "Hello," I say, with as much fake cheer as I can muster. She asks after the family. We tell her we've been well. The family is well. Thank you for asking.
"Anna just won a prize for her research," Louis says.
"Congratulations," she says to me.
"Thank you," I reply, then immediately ruin it by smirking and lifting one eyebrow in involuntary, gleeful triumph. Louis has put his arm around my shoulders and is giving me a kind of one-arm hug.
"I'm very happy for you," she says, and I don't know if she means about the prize or about Louis. I keep thinking about what June said, about how I should see them together and gauge their reaction. Now is the moment. I am looking for any evidence that they are still in touch, still screwing behind my back, and I can't find one exactly. I search Louis's face for any telltale sign, a tightening around the mouth, a quivering of the nostrils, and I find it. It's when she says, "It's nice to see you." He turns bright red. Then he rubs his hand over his chin, and I bite the inside of my cheek until I taste blood. They are trying to appear relaxed, casual even, as they chat about the art world. "Have you seen so-and-so's show? What are you working on at the moment?" What would I do if they were still cheating behind my back, I wonder? I don't know. I'd drag him away, move the family to Martha's Vineyard and add a moat around our house for good measure. I'd expose her, shame her. I'm not one to shame women when there's adultery involved, but now that I'm the wronged party, screw it. I'd personally carve the letter A on her smooth as an egg forehead. Then something completely unexpected happens. A man, good-looking, athletic build, nice square jaw, joins us. He puts one arm around Isabel's waist and shakes Louis's hand.
"Hey, buddy, long time. How are you?"
"I'm great, Patrick. This is my wife, Anna."
I manage to close my jaw and say hello, and my gaze darts from Louis to Isabel to Patrick. Louis seems to know a lot about Patrick. He asks him about some deep-sea diving trip he took last summer and how their vacation plans are coming along. Everything shifts in an instant, and suddenly I am sure of nothing. Is it possible that it was never Isabel? Maybe I had my wires crossed, and there really was another woman called Belle who's been screwing my husband. Have I been so wrong? Do I see desire between every woman and my husband as a matter of course? Am I so insecure that I can't tell anymore? "Hey, you guys want to come over for dinner?" I blurt, interrupting everyone. I suddenly really want to see them together, up close over an evening. Louis and Isabel, Patrick and Isabel, Louis and Patrick. I want to know. There's a chorus of, "Oh, sure, why not? Sounds like fun, when?" And everyone pulls out their phone, but it's harder than it looks because everyone is so very busy. "Yeah, sorry, not going to happen until after Christmas for me," Patrick says, explaining he has to travel to Colorado for a conference, and then somewhere else for something else. We all make noises about what busy lives we lead. Then Patrick turns to Isabel. "But you can go?" And we laugh, because we're not joined at the hip, are we? The way some couples are. Don't we all hate that when one can't make it, then the other is automatically also out of action? "Great! Come next Friday night. It'll be fun," I say very brightly. Too brightly. She smiles sweetly and taps the date into her calendar. We say goodbye like old friends. She kisses me, one on each cheek. The collar of her coat is tall and folded back over itself. It gapes slightly as she leans to kiss me, and when I pull back, I catch a glint of something. Just between the tip of her collarbone and the hollow of her throat, two thin diamond baguettes on a gossamer thread of gold. Chapter 20. After that, I had to get as far away from Louis as I could without leaving the market. I didn't trust myself not to have some kind of breakdown. Just the effort of pretending nothing was wrong as I idly fingered a collection of old tobacco tins was making my chest hurt. But he followed me, stood next to me, and picked up a green tin, I think. I couldn't see properly. My vision had become blurry. "I didn't know Isabel had a boyfriend," I said, the only mildly good news in this whole screwed-up scenario. He made a sound like, "Hmm?" and slipped his arm into mine. I pulled away. I had to. I reached for something else on the display table, but I didn't move away this time. I wanted to ask more, like, did they live together and were they engaged to be married, when he said, "Why did you do that?" I waited a beat, confused. "You mean, invite her for dinner?" "Yes." "Oh, I don't know. It just came out." "Okay," he said. "Why? Is there a problem?" "No, there's no problem." "I would have preferred it if you checked with me first, that's all."
"Oh, I see."
Then for some unknown reason other than a deep-seated habitual response, I add, "Sorry." "That's okay. It's no problem. Just saying." I said I had a headache after that and lay on my bed all afternoon, one arm flung over my eyes. I couldn't stop picturing that necklace around her thin white neck. I got up eventually, and I was sitting at my dresser, my face buried in my hands, when Carla came into my room. I didn't hear her until she put her hand on my shoulder and said, "I love you, Mommy." I raised my head and ran both hands over my eyes before turning to face her.
"That's so sweet, baby. Thank you." "I love you too, baby girl."
I haven't called her that in years. I snatched a tissue from the box and blew my nose. "Hay fever," In winter, I really need to get some antihistamines.
She put her arms around me and lay her head on my shoulder. Hey, I'm okay, sweetie. Just trying to get rid of this runny nose. Whose turn is it to pick a movie tonight?
I hated myself for letting her see me like this. After she left, I washed my face and stared at my reflection in the mirror. I tried to see myself the way Isabel might see me. Old. Boring. Ordinary. Unworthy. But I have children. His children. And I will do anything to protect my family. I sat tall and pulled myself together. I thought of my mother for some reason. Probably because she would find all this display of emotion weak. I gave myself a pep talk. I held my head high and pushed my shoulders back. I told myself to stop being so pathetic. I'll deal with Isabel, I told myself in the mirror, close enough for my breath to leave a cloud of mist. I'll deal with Isabel. Then I wiped it with my hand and went downstairs to be with my family. At work the next day, I'm walking down the corridor, coffee in a styrofoam cup in my hand. I have sunglasses on because my eyes look red and tired.
You look awful. You all right?
June asks. I give a quick shake of my head. I spot Melanie walking towards me with another girl I don't recognize. When Melanie comes level with me, she blows a small bubble of gum and pushes it out with her tongue.
You don't look very happy, Mrs. S.
I'd be happier if you could submit your test on time, Melanie, I say to her. There won't be another extension. You get that? I'll fail you if you don't deliver. She scoffs as I walk right past and I stop her in her tracks with one hand on her shoulder. She jerks back.
Geez, okay, Mrs. S, keep your pants on.
Hey, I snap, pointing an angry finger right into her face. Don't talk to me like that. Is that clear? I'm not one of your friends. I said, is that clear? The corners of her mouth drop.
Yes, I'm sorry.
I turn back, walk around the corner and into my office. I drop my bag on my desk and set down my coffee next to it. Some of it has spilled on my fingers, and I dig out a crumpled tissue from my pocket to wipe them. Then I drop it on the floor without looking where it lands. I sit down heavily. My eyes are burning with the gallons of tears I've been holding back all the way here.
What's going on?
June asks. I didn't hear her come in. I press my fingers into my eyes. I'm scared, I wail.
Why?
I think he's going to leave me.
What?
She closes the door and sits opposite me.
What happened?
I tell her about finding the receipt in Lewis's bag, about my visit to the jeweler. Then I tell her about running into Isabel at the market. I tell her about Patrick. I describe the scene linearly, frame by frame, all the way to its shocking conclusion. It's not that I want to relive it so much as I want June to know every little detail, so we can dissect and analyze and go over every moment with a fine-tooth comb until she points a way forward. A solution. A cupcake ending. Up till then, I honestly thought maybe the necklace was for me. She rests her chin in her hands.
Tell me again, how was Lewis during this whole exchange?
I take a moment to find the right word. Edgy, I think. Ill at ease. He was put out that I invited her. He actually said I should have checked with him first.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Is it? I pop the lid off my cup of coffee. Tell me, why? What am I missing?
Think about it. You said so yourself. You two have been really good lately, isn't that right?
I take a sip. And?
Maybe she's hanging on. Maybe he made a mistake and fixed it, broke it off. And now you invite her for dinner?
She looks at me sideways, and I laugh. Oops. Then my door opens wide, and Jeff appears. He looks at me, then at June. He crosses his arms over his chest.
Well, isn't this cozy? Am I interrupting something?
He points to June.
Who are you again? Oh, yeah, my assistant.
Sorry, Jeff, I say. I'll return her in a sec. He narrows his eyes at me.
What's the matter?
Nothing. Why?
You look upset.
I shake my head. Just tired. Give us a moment, will you?
Sure, sure. Take all the time you need.
Thank you, June and I say in unison.
So, what are you going to do?
She asks, after he's gone. I don't know. My coffee is getting cold by now, and I take a bigger gulp. What do you think I should do? She doesn't reply, just thinks about it for a moment.
See how dinner goes. You're still having her over for dinner, right?
I wasn't going to.
Oh, but you must. This is the only opportunity you'll have to judge the situation.
She stands up and pats my shoulder.
By the end of it, you'll know. And if it's really bad and they're still together...
Then what? She lifts her shoulders in a half shrug.
You'll think of something.
Later, on the way back from the tutorial room, I spot Jeff at the end of the hallway, leaning against the pale green wall, talking to a student. He sees me and raises his arm in my direction.
Anna, come over here.
When I reach him, he puts his arm on my forearm and turns back to the student.
I'll talk to you later, Ivan.
Then he puts his arm around my shoulders and leads me away.
I just want to show you something. It's for the Forrester lecture. It'll only take a minute.
For some reason, we end up standing outside the store cupboard. It's where we get our stationery supplies, which are kept under lock and key. It's also a storage room, filled mostly with cardboard archive boxes piled high against one wall. On the opposite wall are metal shelves filled with cleaning supplies. He glances both ways before pulling out a set of keys from his pocket and unlocking the door.
What are you doing? I ask.
Just wait.
He's talking to my breasts. He pulls me inside and closes the door.
What are you?
But he pushes me against the metal shelves and an aerosol can clatters to the floor.
Oh, God.
No, sorry, Jeff. I press my palms against his chest to push him away, give a small, embarrassed laugh.
I don't think so.
He presses harder against me.
Come on, Anna, he growls. Tell me, what have you been doing with June anyway?
He rubs his groin against me.
You two are always together, whispering to each other like schoolgirls. Then this morning the two of you were in your office with the door closed and you were crying. I saw you. What are the two of you up to, eh?
A wave of panic engulfs me. I'm too far from the door to get out easily. He's too heavy, pressed against me like that. The shelves start to wobble behind me and something cuts into the small of my back.
Enough, Jeff! What are you doing?
I push harder, start to shout, but he puts his hand on my face, extended so that his fingers are over my eyes and the palm of his hand is over my mouth. The taste of his skin makes me gag. He licks the side of my neck.
What does your husband say? Does he know about you and June?
Stop!
But my words are muffled. I can't breathe. My fingers frantically search behind me for something I can use against him, but there's nothing. I wedge my knee between his thighs, and he laughs softly, like I'm doing it on purpose, like I'm enjoying this. He moves his hand to hold my chin, fingers like a vice on either side of my jaw. I take a desperate breath.
Get off me!
I shout as loudly as I can, my voice shrill with fear, my mouth distorted by his grip. I grab his wrist just as he brings his mouth close to mine. His breath is hot and reeks of stale alcohol.
"Come on," he groans into my face. "I know you want to. Don't tell me you're just a tease. You've been wanting me to do this to you ever since you first laid eyes on me."
He brings his free hand up my skirt, his fingers sliding up my thigh.
"How does that feel? Is that nice?"
His mouth is against mine, hot and wet, making me heave. I let out a wail, twist my head away, then grab his hand and bite it. He jerks away suddenly.
"Hey, what did you do that for?"
He stares at his finger where my teeth have left a reddening crescent. He massages it, an astonished look on his face.
"What the hell is wrong with you? That really hurt."
I wipe snot off my face with my sleeve. I'm shaking with fury and humiliation.
"You're out of your mind. I'll report you for this."
He jerks his head back, an angry look of scorn and surprise on his face.
"You're a bitch, you know that? You're just a tease. You've been at me like a bitch in heat since forever. And what about Chicago, eh? You played the tease then, and I let you get away with it. But you never stopped coming on to me, did you? You want to play it that way again? Then you better watch yourself, Anna. Nothing good happens to women like you."
Does he actually believe I ever wanted this? I straighten my skirt, my entire body vibrating with anger while he straightens his clothes. He opens the door, and light floods in from the corridor. Students walk past, their heads swinging towards me in unison. A burst of laughter.
"I won't let you get away with this,"
I say between my teeth.
"Oh, really? What are you going to do, Anna? Report me? Who do you think you are? You want to tell them about Chicago? Or shall I? Because there's bound to be a whole lot of people who saw you get drunk and come on to me like you couldn't get enough of me. Plenty of people who saw us leave together that night. And I don't think your behavior was leaving much to the imagination, but hey, your call."
He snorts.
"And by the way,"
he rests one hand on the door handle,
"Mila says you're avoiding her. That you refuse to talk about how you came up with the solution. What's that about?"
He waits, chin forward, but I don't reply. I wipe my cheeks with trembling fingers and he shakes his head in disgust, steps into the corridor, then changes his mind and turns around again.
"And one more thing. You know why you didn't get the professorship?"
My chest is rising with every loud breath. I run my trembling fingers through my hair.
"I never submitted your application to the board. That's why. I never even nominated you."
He smirks. I search his face, looking for the lie, for the joke, for the punchline. I think of all the extra work I did, the many conversations I had with him about the best way to approach my application. All the proposals I devised, wrote, and submitted. Funding proposals, asset refurbishment proposals, how to attract more young women to study mathematics proposals. All to show I am a team player, a rallier. He answers his own question.
"I wasn't going to waste my time. I knew you wouldn't get it, so I didn't bother submitting it."
"You're an asshole," I say, my voice low and shaky. He shrugs.
"Maybe. And maybe I was wrong. You certainly surprised us all cracking the Penti stone. But maybe I was right. Maybe you're hiding something. Maybe you're just a fraud. But hey,"
he taps the door twice with the palm of his hand,
"we'll find out one way or another, won't we?"
Chapter 21. I've washed my hands, my face, rinsed my mouth, popped mints to fend off the impending nausea. I stare at my own reflection. Did I really bring this upon myself? Was I so taken by his attentions that I misunderstood what was going on? I know you want to. You've been at me like a bitch in heat since forever. And a part of me thinks it's true, that it's my fault. I sent the wrong signals. Even in the face of such violence, I can't help but think it's me. Because in the end, it's always me. Even when it's other people, it's me. I already know I won't do anything about him. Nothing at all. For all my bluster about my family and what I'm prepared to do for them, I am a coward. I couldn't bear for Lewis to find out about Chicago, and I have no doubt Jeff would make sure he does. For all I know, that's all Lewis needs to run into Isabel's arms for good. I bring my hand over my eyes, Jeff's parting words still ringing in my ears. Maybe you're hiding something. Maybe you're just a fraud. For a terrifying moment, I think he knows, has always known. But I make myself breathe, tell myself he doesn't know, because if he did, he would have said something by now. Wouldn't he? It'll keep. That's what I tell myself as I wipe mascara off my cheeks in the staff bathroom. I can deal with it later. It's better for everyone if I wait until after the Forrester lecture. My word will have more weight then. I come up with so many ways to rationalize my own cowardice, the words stop having any meaning. I'm okay. It's okay. It's all okay. I can deal with it. Where's the rush? He's not going anywhere. I avoid him as the week goes on. Plead too much work and avoid meetings. He throws me a look of contempt whenever he passes me, and I pretend I don't notice. After a few days, I think it's not so bad. Soon, I'll forget it ever happened. Everything will return to normal. Meanwhile, Mila is still at me, like an overenthusiastic puppy, nipping relentlessly at my ankles.
Did you remember to bring your notes, Anna? I'm holding off publishing our interview until I get that material. I can't wait to see them. I'd love to know how you did it, how your brain works. Oh, no? What a shame. Where do you think they might be? I mean, you must have something, right? You didn't pop this work out of thin air, did you? You'll be in trouble if you did. Ha ha.
Is that a coincidence? This fixation she has about my notes? Did Jeff speak to her about his doubts? I can't stand it anymore. This paranoia that's twisting my insides all the time. Like no matter which way I turn, someone is out to get me. Mila, please. Why don't we leave it for now? I have the Forrester Foundation lecture to prepare for.
Okay, I get it. You're a perfectionist like me. But it would be great if I could have your notebooks before the lecture. After all, we are your university. It would be nice to have this information before you present it. Like a scoop.
She chuckles at her own wit. Of course. I'm on it. She gives me a small nod, like she doesn't really believe me.
So how about Friday, then?
I can't think of anything, so I tell her Friday is good. I'll have to think of something before then. I'm already exhausted thinking of all the excuses I'll need to drum up before she leaves me alone. All sorted, then, I lie. Over lunch, June and I dissect the Isabel situation.
I think it's an excellent idea to have her over for dinner. Make sure she sees how happy you and Lewis are.
Friday comes around, and I'm walking out of a class trying to avoid the students piling out into the corridor as I turn my phone back on. There's a message from Isabel, and for a moment I think she's going to cancel on me, that she's got cold feet, and I'm already annoyed because I spent all week designing the menu. Baked oysters and cheese puffs for entrees,
venison Wellington with scalloped potatoes and cremini mushrooms in a cream and rosemary sauce, chocolate brownies, which I stayed up until midnight last night to bake, to be served with mascarpone cream plus a dash of Grand Marnier for the adults. And I left work early yesterday so I could shop for it all and still have time to cook dinner for my family. I call her back, the phone wedged in the crook of my neck, one hand holding my satchel open, the other shoving a bunch of papers inside.
"We're still on for dinner tonight?" she asks.
She sounds so sweet, so eager. A bell rings and students pour into the corridor from various directions, out of one class and into another. "Sorry, Mrs. S," they mutter as they bump into me.
I picture the necklace and feel my pulse quicken. I decide to sound forgetful because I can't help myself.
"Dinner, tonight.
You don't remember?"
"Oh, yes, of course I do." There's a pause.
"Anna, it's okay if you want to change plans."
Suddenly, I think maybe I was too convincing, while another part of me, I am made of many parts, is thinking,
"Yes, please, I'm so tired. How about we do it another day and I'll just go home and put everything in the freezer and curl up in bed and tell Lewis I'm sick, and can he please deal with the kids and empty the dishwasher?" But I rally.
"No, of course not. There's a lot going on here and my brain is like a sieve. I'm really looking forward to it." I reel off the address and she says Lewis already gave it to her. "And can she bring something?"
"Nothing at all, just you," I say. "Okay, I'll bring some wine then. I'll see you tonight."
The upside of this is that when Mila turns up to my office, tapping her watch, telling me she's been waiting for me and did I bring my notes, I get to apologize profusely and tell her I'd completely forgotten.
"Brain like a sieve, I swear."
I buy flowers on the way home, a bunch of cellophane-wrapped white lilies to cheer myself up.
I'm so tired, my feet are shuffling instead of walking.
It's going to be a long night.
Chapter 22. I've put the flowers in a vase, and I'm running an eye over the living room, checking every detail like a forensic scientist at a murder scene. I want everything to look perfect. I want everything to look happy. "This is a happy home," I tell myself as I plump up cushions and wipe a wine stain from the glass coffee table. In the kitchen, the surfaces are gleaming, and still I run a cloth over them. Sometimes I go to other people's houses and the first thing I see is the dirt crusted in the corners of the window frames, or spots of tomato sauce on the splashback behind the stove, and I have to fight the urge to pick up a sponge and scrub the place. I've already made the cheese puffs, so they just need to be warmed up. The venison is cooking gently on one shelf in the oven, and I'm getting the potatoes and mushroom dish ready to put on the other oven shelf when the doorbell rings. Isabel isn't due for another 40 minutes, so it can't be her, which is just as well because I am not ready. I've done my hair, but I still have to do my makeup. I bought a contouring kit. Completely unlike me, my makeup kit consists of one tube of mascara and one tube of lipstick. It goes without saying I've never used a kit before, but I checked out a couple YouTube videos on how to make your cheekbones higher and your eyes wider and your chin more defined and your face more desirable, generally speaking. I wipe my hands on the tea towel, and for a crazy moment I think maybe it's Jeff, that he has come to my house to... No, I'm going insane. Of course it's not Jeff. Still, when Carla bounds down the stairs, I put my arm out to stop her while I peer around the blinds. But it is Isabel after all, and I'm strangely disappointed. I would almost have preferred if it was Jeff, or Ryan even. Anyone but Isabel, because I am absolutely not ready for her.
"Hello."
She stands there, a bottle of wine in one hand and a white box with a pretty pink ribbon in the other.
"I know I'm early," she says, biting her bottom lip daintily.
She looks stunning in her white coat and light blue woolen dress. Even the snow crystals scattered throughout her thick blonde hair look magical, like she's just glided over from the set of Frozen. Now I'm really nervous. I wish Louis was home, but he chose this very day to help his dad trim a tree that was in the way of the TV aerial. When I pointed out there was a lot to prepare for this evening, he insisted, conveniently I thought, that it had to be today. He won't be back for a while, maybe even another hour. And I've already drunk half a bottle of wine, which was possibly a mistake.
"I slightly underestimated how far you live. Is that okay? I could wait in the car if you prefer and come back later. I was going to do that, but then I thought the wine should be in the refrigerator, so here I am. And this is pecan caramel cheesecake, by the way. And I didn't make it, in case you're wondering."
I take the box from her. "I wasn't," I say, recognizing Mario's patisserie's sticker on the cake box, thinking I wish she'd told me I wouldn't have made the brownies if I'd known. But then I tell myself it's sweet and that it's going to be a long night if I'm already overthinking things, so I should just stop right now.
"Hello,"
Carla says. "Sweetheart, this is a friend of mine, Isabel." Carla tilts her head at me as if to say, "Friend? Don't be silly. You don't have any friends." "She's a friend of Daddy's, too," I say. "A very good friend of Daddy's."
"It's nice to meet you, Carla. You look just like your mom. How old are you?"
14.
Carla says, pulling her sleeves over her hands and standing with one socked foot over the other.
14 is a great age, isn't it, Anna?
And I'm thinking, is it? Not where I came from.
Very.
Come in, Isabel. I've only just started cooking, but you can sit and fill me in on what you've been up to since, well, since you were born, I guess. I laugh. Carla stares at me sideways, trying to understand why I'm being weird. Isabel is too polite to do so. I take her coat and immediately scan her throat for the necklace, but her dress has a collar and I can't see it. I consider saying something like, "Oh, wait, you have a leaf stuck there. Let me get it for you," just so I can tug at it, but I don't. I touch my hair self-consciously as I lead her through to the kitchen. She looks so fresh and well put together, whereas I look like the local drug dealer with my messy hair and my gaunt, unmade face. Maybe once Louis finally gets home, I could sneak upstairs and slap gallons of whatever is in that contouring kit on my face.
"I'd better finish dinner,"
I laugh for no reason whatsoever.
"Would you like something to drink, Isabel?"
"Yes. How about this?"
She brandishes the bottle of Chardonnay, and I wonder if she caught me looking at it greedily moments earlier. I pull out a glass for her, which makes me think of the elegant tall-stem glasses in Louis's studio, which makes my hand twitch and I spill some of the wine on the table. I tear off a paper towel, laugh again, this time in a way that threatens to reach maniacal proportions, and wipe it off. It really is going to be a very long night. I check on the venison to steady myself. Then finally I ask,
"Where do you live, Isabel?"
She takes an olive and drops the stone into her palm. I quickly put a small plate in front of her.
"Ohio City," she says.
"Oh, that's nice. I go running there sometimes."
I don't know what's the matter with me. I just seem to blurt out things for no reason whatsoever.
Now, of course, she says, predictably,
"Oh, that's so funny. So do I. We should go running together sometimes."
"Well, that's a coincidence," I say, one hand on my hip. I smile, sort of. It's hard to smile when your whole face is so tense it feels like rigor mortis setting in.
but I'm just pleased the kids have disappeared right now. Because they would absolutely exclaim, "What's wrong with you, Mom? Why are you lying?" Then, mercifully, I am alerted to Lewis's arrival by the excited barks of Roxy.
"God, it's cold outside."
He pats Roxy, then rubs his hands together, and suddenly I feel like I'm in a play, and my kitchen is just a set, and we are all very bad actors delivering our wooden lines.
"Well, it's warm in here. Come on in,"
I chirp. We all laugh, and they say a friendly hello, which I can't help but keep a check on. But so far, so very peck on the cheek. He comes over to me and kisses me on the lips, so that's nice. Then Carla and Mateo erupt into the room to greet their dad, as they do, and suddenly the atmosphere feels warm and festive. Lewis opens another bottle of wine, and the kids settle at the kitchen table, fascinated by this new guest who is a friend of their parents. Isabel asks them lots of questions, none of which are, "How do you like school?" or "What do you want to do when you grow up?" which in their eyes is a definite tick. Then Lewis says, "Why don't we sit down at the dining table?" And I'm thinking, maybe because I'm here cooking? But everyone else seems to think it's a good idea, and they disappear, leaving me in the kitchen with a stained apron, sweating over a three-course gourmet meal for my husband and his floozy. Only then does it occur to me that maybe I didn't think this through. I knock back the rest of the wine. "This is nice," I say, pointing over baked oysters and cheese puffs at a silver ring on her index finger, even though it's not really, but I'm hoping it's from Patrick. I just want to hear her say it.
"Isn't it?"
She slips it off to show me. "It's interesting," I say, handing it back to her. "Kind of like a wonky bagel." "I don't know about that," she says, although I note she purses her lips as she slips it back on, so that's nice. "He's a very interesting metal artist," Lewis interjects. "French."
"Well, ooh la la,"
I quip, then laugh, but they don't, and I wonder, how does he know anyway? Did he give it to her too?
"Are you and Patrick married, Isabel?"
Though she doesn't wear a wedding ring.
"No, we're not. But we're talking about it," she says coyly.
"Really?" Lewis asks.
"That is such wonderful news," I say,
only just restraining myself from clapping.
"What a shame Patrick couldn't make it this evening." "He travels all the time. That's the downside of his work. To me, I mean, not to him. He's an athletics recruiter."
The whole time I'm staring at Lewis, searching for clues and finding none.
"How interesting," I say. "And how did you two meet?"
She says something about being introduced through friends of friends. Then Mateo pipes up.
"Mom and Dad met at school."
"At college, sweetie," I say.
"And Mom fell in love with my dad."
He punctuates this with a mini eye roll, something about the word love.
"But he was going with another girl. Then she died from eating a peanut, so Mom could be with Dad."
He smiles, like it's a fairy tale with a happy ending. No one says anything except for Isabel, who gives a little gasp. Lewis stares at me accusingly. I should never have told that story to Maddie. I laugh.
"What an imagination you have, Maddie. It wasn't quite like that, sweetie."
I turn to Isabel.
"It was awful. What was her name, Lewis?"
"Monica."
"That's right."
I turn back to Isabel.
"Monica had a peanut allergy, and she was usually very careful about what she ate, wasn't she, Lewis?"
"Yes, very."
"So why did she die?"
Carla asks. I desperately want to get off the subject, but I know my children. It's better to tackle things head on and move on.
"She used to bring back cake and sweet things to her room after dinner. We all did.
But that one time she got it wrong. I sigh.
Didn't she have an EpiPen?
Carla asks.
At school, there are two girls with a peanut allergy. They have to carry an EpiPen with them all the time around their neck. There's even a spare one in the school infirmary.
I should hope so, I say. She did have an EpiPen, but it got misplaced that day. Lewis, who has barely spoken throughout this exchange, replies, and it's my turn to shoot him an accusatory stare. It might be the truth, but I don't think it's right to say it in front of the children. It's the kind of tale nightmares are made of. He catches my eye and smiles.
And then I married your mother, and you two monsters came along. How lucky was that?
He gets to his feet and starts piling up the plates.
Okay, who's for dessert?
Maddie screams,
Me!
And Lewis pretends to cut him into pieces to serve on plates. It's a standard joke in our house. So of course, Carla screams,
Me! I'm for dessert!
And Isabel is laughing so much she's holding her stomach. I don't know if she really thinks it's that funny, or she's just playing it up for the kids. Then Lewis asks again, Who's for dessert? And the kids scream,
Isabel!
But Lewis says, What about Mommy? Which is nice, because Mommy never gets to play this game. Mommy is never for dessert. Maybe he tried once, but I wriggled out of it. I suppose that's why. I laugh, extend my arms ready to be cut up to pieces, but they're insistent.
No, Isabel's for dessert!
And I can see Lewis doesn't want to do it. He steals sideways glances at her, probably hoping she'll say something like, No, not me, please cut up Mommy instead. But she doesn't. And the kids are overexcited and they won't let up, so he relents, does his thing, cuts up Isabel in pieces and serves her up on a plate. And I have to say, she's a natural, completely comfortable with my husband's hands on her and my kids pulling her limbs apart.
I'll get the cheesecake,
I say.
Chapter 23. The first time I ever saw Lewis was at the college library. I was scanning the shelves for something, and he appeared beside me. He smelt of something warm and sweet, like the whiff you catch as you walk past a bakery. Sorry, he whispered, reaching across me. I fell in love with him the moment I saw him. Later, I found out he was going out with a girl from my dorm, Monica. I hadn't forgotten her name earlier. I just pretended to. He told me once that she was the first girl he loved. I rolled my eyes when he said that. I mean, every guy was in love with Monica, and it also betrayed a striking lack of imagination. She was the quintessential pretty girl next door. Perfect white teeth, bouncy blonde hair held back with barrettes. Barrettes. I couldn't see what she and Lewis had in common, although she liked to draw, I remember that. I don't think she was any good, though. She used to do portraits of some of the other girls, and they all looked the same, with long heart-shaped faces and wide almond-shaped eyes, like a cross between Barbie and Bambi. A gaggle of Barmbies. We didn't hang out, just passed each other in corridors on the way to the bathroom, her in cute animal slippers, tying the belt on her powder blue bathrobe, me in nylon pajamas and flip-flops. Somehow, Lewis and I became friends. I say somehow as if it was random, but really, I sought him out. Bumped into him on multiple occasions until he recognized me enough to say hi. I remember what his smile did to me back then. Made me weak at the knees. We hung out sometimes, at the library mostly. I studied a heck of a lot more than he did, and we were not in the same classes, but we would still end up at the library at the same time, and we'd sit together at the big table downstairs, me revising physics, him reading about philosophy.
He'd raise his head and catch me watching him. I'd blush furiously and he'd smile. That gorgeous, sexy smile. This only happened whenever Monica was in class, obviously. I asked him once, long after we became a couple, if he knew then how deeply in love I was with him, and he just smiled that same smile and didn't say anything. There was a party one night, and I knew Monica and Louis would be there. As it happened earlier that day, I saw her get herself a treat from the cafeteria. She brought it back to her room. She did that sometimes. I know, because I did watch her a lot. The last time I saw her, I was in the bathroom washing my face, getting ready for the party, when Monica walked in. She barely acknowledged me, stepped into one of the shower cubicles with her pink plastic bathroom bag and her fluffy slippers. I went to the party, but Monica didn't. Louis was there, alone, looking forlorn. I stayed close to him all night. I plied him with sangria in which I'd poured generous slugs of rum. Isn't that what we were supposed to do, us crazy college kids? Then I tried to kiss him, but he gently pushed me away and slurred in my face. His eyebrows knotted together.
"I'm sorry, Anna. I just really love Monica."
I giggled, slapped him on the chest playfully, said I hadn't meant to kiss him anyway. He pretended to believe me, but the rejection left me feeling worse than I'd anticipated. By the time I returned to my dorm, there were ambulances outside and chaos in the corridor. Monica had eaten the wrong cake. Her EpiPen was nowhere to be found. She'd lost it somewhere, was the conclusion, and hadn't noticed until it was too late. Louis was devastated. But I was right there. I comforted him, consoled him, talked to him softly late into the night, every night. I wrapped my arms around him and I never let go. I was in love with Louis, but he was with Monica. Then Monica ate a peanut, and he was mine. I watched them from the kitchen door. Especially her. I can see her perfect profile from my vantage point. She's laughing, tickling my children, and I think about Monica. She looked a bit like Isabel. The blonde hair, the wide smile, the blue eyes. He has a type, my husband. And ironically, I'm not that type. I find myself imagining that I'm watching another family. That Louis is married to someone else, someone like Monica or Isabel. That this is a regular Friday night dinner. They look beautiful, the four of them, like a perfect family tableau. And suddenly it's too much, and I have to look away.
Anyway, I don't know why we're talking about all that, I say when I return, even though no one's talking about all that. They're too busy laughing. I set down the cheesecake more abruptly than I'd meant to, and everyone stops. Louis looks up at me, frowning.
I'm just so glad we finally got to meet properly, I say to Isabel, trying to reinsert myself back into my own family. Somehow Louis gets the message because he calms the kids down and cuts the cheesecake, while Isabel runs both hands through her gorgeous hair, which got all messed up in all the fun they were having. She closes her eyes, slowly shakes her head, and lets her hair fall perfectly back in place. It's like watching one of those slow-motion shampoo commercials. Later, when the children have gone to their rooms, and Louis is in the kitchen loading the dishwasher, Isabel says,
"You have a beautiful family, Anna. You're very lucky."
"Thank you." But I want to tell her it's not just luck. It's hard work. That a family is like a fortress you have to defend all the time. And you can't relax because there's always someone trying to get in, always someone looking for a breach. Someone pretty. Someone pretending to be nice. Someone just like her.
Louis returns and offers coffee, and I flick my eyes up at him. I'm a bit